How has India's foreign policy been? Has there been a shift in the foreign policy in keeping with the shift in the global policy or the geopolitical situations? Has India been conservative or has India adopted a little more aggressive approach? Here is the detailed conversation I, Richa Mishra, had with Professor Harshvi Pant on India's foreign policy in two terms of the NDA regime. So thank you, Professor Pant, for sparing us this time and chatting with our viewers, listeners on the foreign policy of NDA regime. So I want to you to throw some light for us on how have you seen the foreign policy change in the last 10 years. Essentially, our foreign policy, if my memory doesn't fail, was more governed by political, our stance on multilateral bodies on the political front pertaining to our neighborhood, especially. Now we see it more happening on the economic side of it. So if you could just run us through on NDA 1 and NDA 2, and what is the shift in foreign policy that which we have seen?
Thank you. Thank you, Richa, for having me. It's wonderful to be able to talk on foreign policy and share your views with a range of different segments of audiences. I would just say that, foreign policies generally never change dramatically, because they are governed by some immutable factors: your geography, your history, you have your national interests that remain permanent. As we know, it's famous argument that national interests don't change. But I think what has happened in the last decade, if you just look at Modi government's decadal experience, is that the world changed dramatically. I think what has been interesting in this case is that two things have happened. One, of course, Modi government came in with a very different set of ideas about how they wanted to govern India, and how perhaps they thought their role they wanted to carve out for themselves in the world. We often make this argument academically that 2014 was really the time when India shifted from being a center-left polity to being a center-right polity. So in that sense, the politics changed, and therefore it is inevitable that some of the consequences would be felt in foreign policy as well. But I think equally important, the world changed. The world changed dramatically with China's rise, making its presence felt, with America, the Trump phenomena gathering momentum, American isolationism becoming more palpable than ever. And of course, multiple things happened. COVID happened. You had our relations with China undergoing a dramatic shift. That all happened. And India emerging as an economic power. So while you did say that, look, economic dimension has been a very important part, and we have been liberalizing since 1990s, and economics has been gradually becoming a more important part of our foreign policy. We were talking more about investments, economic partnerships. Our ties with America underwent a transformation post-1990s, post-Cold War, because of the economic dynamic partly. So there are a number of factors where economics has become the fundamental shift, but economics also underwent a transformation. If you look at it in the last few years, where geoeconomics today is very, very different from the way we think of economics before. We used to say, let's trade and become friends. Trade was seen as an entity to bring countries together. Now countries are fragmenting. We are saying, let's trade among friends. We have to be very wary of countries where we have over-dependence on certain countries for economic resources, for supply chains, etc. So I think we are looking at a very fundamentally transformed world, and I think a fundamentally transformed India, where aspirations are becoming more important in shaping politics. And therefore, if you combine both of them, you do get a sense that Indian foreign policy did undergo a significant shift. And part of it, what you said, more in the past, focused more on the neighborhood, focused more on the periphery, now having this argument of a global India, then also the economic dimension becoming more salient. And I would finally add the point about non-alignment, that pre-2014, I would say largely you can shape or structure Indian arguments around the centrality of non-alignment, even though gradually post-Cold War we were shedding the baggage of non-alignment. I think post-2014, we have seen non-alignment, at least among the policymakers, hardly being talked about. So we have moved to multi-alignment is the word, strategic autonomy is the word. Now we can debate and discuss what they mean, but I think largely non-alignment is not seen as the central frame through which Indian foreign policy should be framed and pursued.
That's very well explained, Professor Pant. So let me put in a naughty question here then, that if you want to rank or rate how the performance of India 1 and 2 has been at the 1 to 5 in the foreign policy front, where do you put them and why?
I would say NDA one was very cautious because I think Modi government was trying to find its feet. So I would say somewhere around three. NDA two, primarily because so many crises happened. You had COVID, you had Ukraine, you had Galwan. And I think to come through those crises relatively unscathed and to come through those crises. If you look at the fact that India is one of the fastest growing major economy in the world, or the fastest growing major economy in the world, is significant that we have been able to come through by many of these crises, and the fact that at one point when Galwan happened, everyone was very worried about what is going to happen. We are still very worried on the borders, but I think with Russia, I think partly everyone was very worried with Ukraine that look what how is going India going to manage. India has managed relatively well. So I would rank NDA 2 certainly much higher than NDA 1. And maybe this is just simply a question of finding their feet, etc. But I think second NDA, particularly because so many crises came and you had to manage your way through a crisis, and foreign policy largely is measured how you do it, how you perform in a crisis.
Yes.
Crisis management.
So should we say averaging it out to four, if it
I
works?
would say it has been, I would, yeah, I would say 4.
Yeah, it's difficult for a journalist to average.
Even academics, I think we hardly, we are very good at writing verbose phrases, but when you give us a number, we are all worked up.
I'm glad you brought in the Atal Bihari Vajpayee regime, because what we see was footings of the first 5 year, first term of the Narendra Modi government, the basis was that. I mean, he also took certain radical decisions, like we did new Pokhran happened. We did a few things. We survived sanctions during that period, and how? Of course, credit should go to all the women of the country, because gold was the savior, and
Absolutely.
we were clinging on to it. But yes, economic sanctions and all, we survived, and everyone thought we will collapse, but the economy did not collapse. So I just want to now bring into this context, as you very rightly pointed out, that entire geopolitics has changed. How we are, dealing with situations has also changed. So in this perspective, bilateral versus multilateral, do multilateral institutions matter? We see what happens at WTO. So whether it is bilaterals that play a larger role, or is it multilateral, the bodies like WTO still do matter.
Which I think multilateral institutions are really at the very end of their lifeline, it seems to me. That unless they dramatically change, unless there is a dramatic sense that they are able to function, it would be very difficult for them to revive global interest in multilateral institutions. And we have seen a succession of these institutions failing and flailing. We have had UN, of course, the biggest example that look. So many security crises are happening in the world today, from Middle East to Ukraine to Africa, Red Sea. What is UN Security Council doing? No one really knows. I mean, I don't think they even have a voice. I mean, countries are taking independent positions on these issues, and every country is there for itself or herself trying to figure out a response. I don't think UN Security Council has been able to muster enough of a response to any of these big time crises in the world. Now, and then, of course, you talked of WTO. WTO is, there's a wider argument that WTO is going nowhere. And WTO, again, will have to figure out a response to this existential crisis. We also saw WHO, during the COVID. WHO's, I think, lack of performance during COVID is particularly worrying because many had assumed that. All right, hard power, when it comes to hard power, maybe institutions don't work. But when it comes to issues like education, culture, health, UN system would come together, and technical institutions like WHO should be able to give that information to countries, should be able to manage these kinds of crises. But the spectacular collapse of WHO, at least in the initial phase of the COVID crisis, and the politicization of WHO that we saw, I think that meant that there is a there is a serious credibility crisis that the world is facing, that these institutions are facing. And India's response has been very interesting. And I think we have moved, because if you recall, entry into the UN Security Council has been one of the things that every government used to talk about. They still do. This government also talks about that we would like to be on the Security Council. I think the foreign minister has recently made a statement once again about it. But the issue there is this government has given it a certain twist, and which is interesting, and which is indicative of how far things have changed. So when Prime Minister, I think 4 or 5 years back, he was addressing the UN Security Council, he made a point that, look, of course, UN Security, India not being made part of the UN Security Council is troubling for many Indians. And he said, how long will 1.4 billion people wait? But he also said that ultimately it's a problem for the UN system as well. And it's a bigger problem for them, because India may or may not join UN Security Council as a permanent member, but India's growing weight in the international system would mean that every single conversation you will have about the world global governance, you will have to involve India. So whether India sits as a permanent member or not, it really doesn't matter. But it's the credibility of the UN Security Council that is at stake if 1.4 billion people are not represented there. And I think that's a point that increasingly you see that Indian policymakers are shrugging off this issue, that all right, so what, we are not part of the UN Security Council. If we continue to grow our capabilities, then eventually we will become we will have to be involved, that it's no global governance issues could be tackled without India's involvement today. And that I think sends out a message loud and clear that ultimately UN Security Council will have to figure out a response to this and bring countries like India into its fold. Otherwise, the credibility of UN Security Council will continue to be affected. So I think largely multilateral institutions have not really been very effective, and they do not represent today's global order. And therefore, the other I think element that you have seen is the rise of mini laterals, the rise of smaller groupings, ad hoc coalitions, interest-based coalitions, which may not be an answer to global governance, because smaller groupings really can't manage global issues. But I think they are a response that the world is not waiting for multilateral institutions to resolve their tensions and challenges. The world is moving on. And therefore, from Quad and BRICS to regional institutions, to even trilateral frameworks that are emerging fast and furious, particularly in the Indo-Pacific, I think is a sign of things to come. And I think this will only accelerate if multilateral institutions do not really get their act together.
That's very well explained. So why my question came was that when this government in the first term came in, they wanted to consolidate all the FTAs, if I'm not wrong. And I said, we're just having too many FTAs and let's start consolidation. And today I see again the FTA is the flavor. The finest example is India-US. Now, we still don't have an FTA, but US, if you permit me to say, is greedy businessman. I mean, they want their returns. They first look at their returns and then they move forward. So how much do you think the FTAs actually influence the relationships which we have with countries, say, for example, with US, or if we are looking in our neighborhood also? We have a particular kind, you mentioned Russia, we have a particular kind of relationship with Russia. We are forever looking like we want to woo US for reasons. Now we have, it looks like come of age, and we say like, okay, you do your work, this is how we work. And that's the finest example in the Ukraine war, which we saw how India positioned itself. But it was a different India during Iran time. As you said, we were more cautious there. Or when we are dealing with our neighbor like Sri Lanka, or are we dealing with China, we are dealing with Nepal, or we Pakistan. We're forever talking trade with them. This will happen, that will happen, then nothing will happen, then we'll again. So we always start from the scratch. So my point was that how much relevance do FTAs play in all this?
I think increasingly we are witnessing, as you mentioned, a resurgence of Indian interest in the FTAs, and I think there is a good reason for that. In the past, as you mentioned, India was not seen as a very credible interlocutor when it came to FTAs, or economic partnerships. India was very cautious. India had, countries were often looking at India as a country that favors protectionism. And there was this sense that India doesn't want to be fully integrated into the global order, that the political economy of India does not allow that to happen. And there was a certain truth to it. We were not very successful, but I think with multiple FTA engagements. You can talk about the India-EU FTA, which has been going on, discussions that have been going on now for almost close to 2 decades, and nothing has moved. And of course, multiple other FTAs. But I think what has happened is that today, economic issues that I mentioned, in the first part of this conversation, are being looked at through the strategic prism. So there is a change, there is a shifting mindset. I think in India, the sense is that this is a moment to capture, that this is India's moment, because China is not really the favored country anymore. And as more companies, more countries look to India as a credible economic partner, India has to give something to them. India has to show that it is open for business. And I think FTAs therefore allow that narrative to become more credible. And you would recall, we have now the SEPA with the UAE, we have Australia, we have signed the deal, we are negotiating three or four of these now with the UK, EU, Canada. And I think that the dynamism there, just the engagement there, and the fact that India is now engaged with a certain degree of seriousness on this issue, is a testament to our times, that this is now a changing world in which India has to position itself differently. And because there is a fragmentation happening at the global economic level, India has to position itself with its partners that are strategically like-minded. And therefore, a lot of these negotiations and a lot of these agreements that are happening are with countries that are politically on the same page, strategically on the same page with India. So while some of these will take some time in coming to fruition, I think UK and EU ones are particularly interesting to watch, because I think there is a sense that there is an inherent momentum there. But I do think that FTAs have suddenly now come back in Indian foreign policy in a big way, and they will continue to be there because India has to position itself as a credible China plus one alternative that the world is looking for. So I would say that I think going forward, and particularly for the next government, this will be a key priority.
So, if I may ask, what are the challenges that still remain for India? I mean, what are the untold stories in the policy which we still have?
I think two or three. One is, of course, the big question, the China question. Where do we go from here? We have identified the problem. We are trying to, Indian policymakers are trying to build resilience within the system, both domestically, as well as trying to link up with like-minded countries. But China is our neighbor. China is a very important neighbor, very powerful neighbor. So what kind of a, what are the new parameters of this relationship we are going to have? The old parameter we know is not working. It has, the phase that we are in today has been described as an abnormal phase in the relationship. And as we move forward, what is the new arrangement that we can come to a consensus on with China, so that it allows us to continue on the path of development, which is the primary responsibility and primary priority of any government that is going to come to power. So if domestic development is the priority, you need a peaceful periphery, and a peaceful border with China is going to be a prerequisite. So what do you do about it? And I think that's going to be one of the most important challenge facing any government that emerges post June 2024. The other, of course, is related, which is, what do you do with the neighborhood? Because neighborhood is suddenly, sometimes India is up, especially the media, the way it portrays it, India wins, China loses, China wins, India loses, that kind of a narrative. One project India gains, and this is a big sign that India is winning. One project that China gains, it's a big sign that China is winning. The story is much more complex and nuanced. I think most countries in the region, they look at China-India relationship as an enabler for their own development. So they are looking at how can you play one off against the other. But ultimately, China's increasing footprint in the neighborhood is challenging India in ways that is now becoming a real problem. So what do you do about the neighborhood? How do you frame a new relationship with the neighborhood? And this whole sense of moving away from SAARC to BIMSTEC, this Bay of Bengal focus that has been there as part of Modi government's foreign policy, how sustainable that is, given that many countries, even in the BIMSTEC community, want SAARC to be revived. Now, it's a challenge because unless Pakistan changes its course, India would not be willing to engage with Pakistan in SAARC. But many of our other neighbors want SAARC to be revived. So that is going to be a challenge in the neighborhood. And the final, I think, challenge is going to be in the wider Indo-Pacific, where India is now increasingly trying to become a larger power, larger sort of a player in the region. There, we have, for example, we are part of the Quad. We engage with US, Japan, Australia as part of the quadrilateral framework. We also engage with many other countries in the region bilaterally. And so the challenge there is, what kind of a security architecture can India create there so that it allows for peaceful development of the region and free and open Indo-Pacific, which is the articulated policy of India. So I think there are going to be a lot of issues going forward, particularly if Mr. Trump is elected once again, which is going to upend a lot of the assumptions on which Biden administration has built the foreign policy, which is much more reliant on partners and allies. And we know from Mr. Trump's past behavior that he's not very particularly interested in partnerships and alliances. So how do we go from there? What kind of an architecture we can create? But finally, I think I would say that the most important issue for India will continue to be how can we keep the growth momentum on? Because ultimately, everything relies on economic growth. So if you don't have that momentum, economic growth, we are well positioned today. I think Indian policy planners have set up very ambitious targets. But if we do not attain that growth, I think all the foreign policy assumptions also start crumbling, because the one reason why India is looked at very, very differently today is its economic capabilities allow India to harness many of its interests in ways that was not possible before. So I think that is going to be a significant thrust area and a challenge for policy.
So my last question, Professor Pant, would be, what is the way forward then?
I think the way forward certainly would continue to be focusing on domestic developmental priorities. And all our partnerships, I think, whether they are with the US, whether they are with Russia, whether they are with Europe, have to be geared towards that. And in that sense, I think that is a continuation of what this government has already done. I think we are way past that phase where we were looking at our partnerships through an ideological lens. There is a very pragmatic underpinning to most of our arrangements. We will buy oil from Russia because it sustains our domestic economy. And we'll continue to do that. We'll continue to get technology, high-end technology, or engage with our high-end technology with the West, because that's very important for the future of our economic growth. So I think there we cannot afford to make ideological distinctions and ideological partnerships. So I think that in some ways is going to be a continuation of what we have done. But I think the second element will have to be, if we are trying to think more creatively about China, what are the possibilities that exist? We know that despite all our efforts, our trade with China is not going down, and it will continue to rise. It will continue to, because that is something that India also doesn't want to disrupt, because it impacts Indian economy. So what do you do to ensure that your critical infrastructure, your critical strategic technologies, your critical strategic industries are in some ways firewalled from Chinese interference, but at the same time, it does not preclude India from engaging with China on economic matters. And I think a related aspect, final aspect to this would be the question that you have raised is, what kind of FTAs or economic partnerships can we devise with countries so that it allows us to leverage their economic strengths in our own developmental journeys?
So it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much for sparing us this time.
Thank you. Thank you,
We'll
Richa.
pick your on your brains shortly.
No, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. It was lovely.
Thank you.